Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The Super Bowl is the biggest sports betting event of the year, but is Delaware leaving money on the table with its limited wagering options?
90% or greater of bets and money wagered are placed online through mobile apps, and without that advantage, Delaware is falling behind.
We talked to a sports betting expert about sports betting in the first state. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also examine the final act in a long-running court battle over how Delaware appoints judges, and start Black History Month with a look at how the country recognizes Black history. Plus, our playlist offers a poetry lesson. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware gets tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Super Bowl is the single biggest sports betting event each year. And with the Eagles making it to this year's big game in Arizona, plenty of people locally may be interested in putting their money where their mouth is. But even though Delaware had sports betting before most other states, placing sports wagers here isn't as easy as it is elsewhere, including neighboring Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Maryland. This week, I caught up with ESPN writer David Purdom, who covers the gambling industry, to look at the state of sports betting in the first state and get some advice on putting bets on pro football's biggest game of the year. Delaware was notably the first state to allow sports betting after the Supreme Court's 2018 decision, legalizing it, was allowed to actually even offer parlay betting before that due to an exception it had. But since then, it's done very little to really expand its operation, while others around it, New Jersey, Maryland, Pennsylvania, have started to pass them by, particularly in the area of sports, mobile sports betting. Is Delaware leaving a lot of revenue on the table here by not pushing the envelope at least a little bit further?
Yeah, it is. And you nailed it. Those surrounding states, the key word there is mobile. 90% or greater of bets and money wagered are placed online through mobile apps. And without that advantage, Delaware is falling behind. It's just too easy. It's almost easier to hop in your car and drive across the state line and place a bet on your phone than it is to drive down to one of the racetracks to do it in person. And that's the preferred method for the majority of American sports bettors.
And we're already seeing it in terms of the numbers that Delaware is doing, according to the Delaware Lottery, which runs sports betting and other gambling here in the state. Delaware saw a 7% drop in sports wagering recently. I guess, how are those three racetrack casinos and their sports books affected by this dynamic that's kind of risen up around them? I mean, it would seem that it is really a major blow to them.
Yeah, I mean, the idea is to increase traffic, right, to the horse tracks, to the racetracks. Come out here, place your bet, enjoy the races, get people out there, get people to buy concessions and so forth. The problem is that they are just such a larger audience of mobile sports bettors that are not really interested in going to the track at all. And again, it would be easier for them to drive across, hop on your phone, log on, and place a wager. And so the revenue gained by the foot traffic, and this is proven out in Las Vegas. A long time ago, they thought about the same thing. Oh, we don't want people betting on their phones. We want them to get in there into the casino and play the higher margin slots and so forth. But overwhelmingly, it has turned out to be not the case. It doesn't necessarily hurt your foot traffic that much if you are to legalize mobile betting, and it only increases revenue.
If Delaware had been more proactive at the beginning, or even more recently, could the early advantage it had, starting sooner than everybody else, minimize the impact of the arrival of sports betting in the surrounding states? Or is that always going to be kind of baked into an erosion of what Delaware could make?
I think it's going to be baked in. You are going to work in your population area. There always are going to be these other states that are going to take more of the revenue away with their mobile betting. You know, Delaware thought about it. We all thought they were going to do it in 2018 when the Supreme Court changed the rule. Delaware was first. We thought mobile betting was going to follow. My understanding was the lottery took a look at the costs associated with mobile betting. A lot of that comes from the geolocation required. You have to make sure people are betting or inside the state, and that's an expensive process. And the lottery just decided that they weren't comfortable with the costs associated. Now, Fast forward, what, going on 6 years here will be the decision anniversary in May, and they may have to relook and see what they need to do here.
It's always felt to me like some of the tension also, beside the cost that you mentioned, was the fact that Delaware has always based all of its gambling on this idea of tying it to the horse racing industry. Even in the past, there was studies done and committees formed to look at adding casinos elsewhere, and they said you should add one by Wilmington and the PA line. You should add one by the beaches. Is that persistent tying it to the horse tracks really problematic?
Not necessarily tying it to the horse track. I mean, we talked about it. It's mobile. People don't want to get off their couch. They don't want to leave their phone or leave their sofa, to go place a bet. When you can do it so easily and so efficiently with the mobile app, it doesn't matter where you put the sports book at it, whether it's at a casino, a racetrack, or a beachfront, beachfront resort or wherever, still people who are going to want to place their bets on their phone, it's just that much easier.
One recent development is two of the state's casinos, Delaware Park and what was Dover Downs and is now Bally's Dover, have gone from local ownership to larger entities that have casino interests elsewhere. Is the sense that those new owners may be ones who want to lobby the state for mobile sports betting, expanded sports betting? Is that something we've seen elsewhere, that the corporate interests play a big role here?
Oh, absolutely. They're going to get their lobbying power behind it. And they know that, hey, if you don't have mobile sports betting, you are behind the eight ball and you are not going to be able to generate the handle. The handle is the amount wagered on there. And that, of course, generates the revenue from that. So until you get mobile sports betting, you're going to be behind the eight ball. And these companies that are coming in here, Bally's, as you mentioned, are going to be big proponents and they'll put their power behind the lobbying efforts to get this done.
Is there still time for Delaware to recapture some of the market if they could wave a magic wand and start mobile betting tomorrow? Could they see a significant boost in the revenues the companies would see, and then obviously the state share that they would get from all that?
100%. Not only are the convenience of mobile betting, but the types of wagers that you can offer come with mobile betting. Live betting, where you can bet play by play instead of running up to the window and trying to get a bet in. You can do this instantaneously on your phone. And in-game wagering is becoming a bigger and bigger part of sports betting in America. So get the mobile sports betting. Not only will you increase the revenue and the convenience for your consumers, but you'll increase the betting options that they're available. And some of these ones, including these things called same game parlays, where you can place multiple bets on one game and you can do it live when the game is happening. Those have really high margins compared to going to the game, going up to the window before a game, placing a single bet on a point spread. The margins on those compared to these other multiple leg parlay wagers, as Delaware is familiar with from its past, there's just no real comparison. We're talking extremely more lucrative offerings are available if you have mobile betting.
And that mobile betting, I'm assuming, captures the more casual better than having to go to the book.
Yeah, it captures them all, but it definitely with the recreational bettors as well.
So we are coming up on the Super Bowl, huge sports betting day. Let's talk a little bit more writ large about sports betting. How much has the expansion of legalized sports betting, and specifically, the mobile option, changed the dynamic of Super Bowl betting, and how much money is likely to be bet on the Super Bowl?
You're going to see billions of dollars will be reported being bet on the Super Bowl. We got right near $1 billion last year, and now we have more states coming on board. So you'll get over $1 billion wagers. Some of the estimates, when you include Super Bowl pools and those
The
squares,
squares.
Super Bowl squares that people love to do, and so forth, you'll see multi-billion dollars wagered when you include all that kind of stuff. But the legalization of sports betting has changed a lot. We have, for the first time this year, there will be a sports book, a retail sports book on the premises over there at State Farm Stadium in Arizona, where the Super Bowl is held. It's a BetMGM sports book. So that'll be the first time we have that. That was almost, unfathomable a few years ago when we first had legalization. The NFL was still a little bit cautious and hesitant. Not anymore. All those sports leagues are on board. You're seeing more and more stadiums put sports books in. So It's really changed. And of course, all the commercials that everybody sees, and you will start to see more and more as we get closer to the Super Bowl for this big, trying to grab market share. We're still in the early years of this, and companies are trying to fight for the most market share, the most bettors they can get on their platform.
So for someone who might just be dipping their toe into sports gambling for the Super Bowl, are there some basic things they should know or perhaps avoid? Is there kind of just feeling out what they can do and maybe what they should or shouldn't do?
Yeah, my always advice to people is bet the smallest amount your sports book will let. You can bet a bunch of bets, bunch of them, but make them, the smallest you have. If you have $100 that you're willing to bet on the Super Bowl, maybe you divide that up and you bet five $20 bets or 10 $10 bets. Never really want to start pushing all in on one bet because things happen are crazy. So to make your enjoyment last longer, to make your bankroll last longer, bet the smallest amount you can and look at it as fun. You're not going to turn and suddenly into some professional bettor here on the Super Bowl. You need to take this as entertainment, as fun, and try to be as cautious as possible with your bankroll.
So you've talked about some of the numbers that we could see on Super Bowl Sunday. Looking at sports betting writ large, when you add in everything else, college basketball, pro basketball, everything else, how big can it get? Do we have any sense of where the ceiling could be for sports betting at this point?
Well, we still have three big states that have not gotten there with legalization: Florida, Texas, and California. And you get those three in there, and it's going to be significantly jumping up the total amount bet. We're talking billions of dollars of bet, hundreds of billions of dollars of bet annually now with U.S. sports books. And when we say that, let's not forget that there is still an underground bookmaking market. Before legalization, people just weren't betting; they were just finding other options. And there are bookmakers that will allow you to bet on credit that operate out of sports bars, that operate out of country clubs. There are offshore sports books that you can play at. We don't get to see a lot of how much is bet with those, of course, but the ones with the legal shops, you're looking at hundreds of billions of dollars. And once we get those other three states in, I believe that Texas and Florida will be the first two. California will be the last to come on board. But when those three giants come in, you're looking at hundreds of billions of dollars. I wouldn't shy away from saying $400 to $500 billion a year would be wagered on sports in the U.S. when we reach full maturity.
Thanks to ESPN's David Purdom for joining us on The Green this week. And stay with us. We dig into the resolution of the long-running court battle over how Delaware appoints judges. That's next here on The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The long-running legal battle over how Delaware picks judges for some of its courts appears to be over. After 5 years and two separate cases, the tussle over the state's judicial balance provisions involving Wilmington lawyer James Adams and Governor John Carney ends with a consent decree where the Carney administration concedes part of Delaware's rules for filling seats on its top three courts is unconstitutional. Adams, who is politically unaffiliated, challenged the state's major party provision. That requires applicants for seats on the Supreme Court, Superior Court, and Court of Chancery to be from one of the two major parties, Democratic or Republican. Adams' first challenge failed when the U.S. Supreme Court decided he lacked standing. But a federal judge ruled last fall that new facts presented in Adams' second challenge established legal standing to move forward, and a trial was set for April. The consent decree does leave the state's bare majority provision intact. That says no more than a bare majority of judges on those courts can be affiliated with a single political party. So why did the Carney administration move to settle the dispute now? And what does this move mean for how the state appoints judges going forward? Constitutional law scholar Alan Garfield, a professor at Widener University's Delaware Law School, joins us this week to offer some answers. Can you tell us a little bit about what this consent decree says and what it does?
Yes. So the Delaware Constitution had set up the appointment process for some courts. So there was two parts of the puzzle. One part, we'll just take the Delaware Supreme Court, was of the five positions, only three could be of one major political party, and the other two had to be part of the other major political party. And that prevented someone who is not a member of either political party, major political party, from being able to be appointed to the court, like James Adams. And the consent decree basically says that the second part, the other major political party for the other two seats on the court, you know, is no longer good law. So it just left in the bare majority provision that three seats could be for just one party, but the other two seats could be for a member of any party.
Or someone who is non-affiliated whatsoever.
Right.
So we'll start with the basic thing is we're assuming this is kind of the end of the road for this case. I'll put it directly to you. Does this definitively put an end to this case, which has dragged on for about 5 years? And as we mentioned, the top two challenges by Wilmington lawyer James Adams, who is trying to apply for positions and did not have a major party affiliation. Is this the end?
Well, I think it's the end in terms of, I think James Adams agrees he's not going to bring any more challenges. I suppose somebody else could come and challenge the bare majority provision. But it looks like for now, you know, things are probably going to stay this way.
Is it fair to say that the state, by going this route, doing a consent decree, kind of saw the writing on the wall? It only won in the U.S. Supreme Court in the first case based on standing. And it appears to me, as I recall, all the other rulings seem to indicate that the major party piece of this process wasn't faring very well with judges. Did the state just say, like, you know what, we're probably going to lose, so we might as well cut bait?
I'm assuming that's what their reasoning was, that in the Third Circuit, as you said, in the district court in the Third Circuit, they lost, that they found not only, you know, they first said the other major political party provision is not constitutional. And then they said, and you can't sever the two. They were intended to be a package. And so they lost on both provisions. And maybe seeing the writing on the wall, as you said, they said, you know what, let's at least keep the bare majority provision, which we think is a good thing, and we'll surrender the other provision that, you know, better to have that resolution, get rid of this lawsuit, than potentially lose both.
I was going to say, you mentioned the severability issue, and the consent decree does speak specifically to the bare majority rule, and essentially is saying that the parties in this case affirm it, that it's okay, it can stand. Now, Adams' lawyer had said that Carney and the state had asked for this specifically, and he suggested it was political cover so it wouldn't look like a total loss. But it sounds like you're suggesting that there was actually a practical reason to add that, and that is to maybe inoculate against further challenges to the thing that's standing, which is the bare majority rule.
Yeah, I'm not sure other people couldn't challenge it, but I think what it does is, you know, like you were saying, they're figuring we could potentially lose both provisions. We think the one provision is a good thing to have in the Constitution. Rather than risk losing both, let's keep this, and probably nobody else is going to challenge it, and we'll at least have preserved part of what we like in the process.
And there was, as I recall, back when this was working its way through the various levels, particularly when it got to the Supreme Court and there was a lot of amicus briefs filed, there was a lot of people who were in support of this system, particularly the bare majority piece. And a lot of people were arguing how important that bare majority piece was. Do you feel like that kind of, you know, factors in here, that there's a lot of people who see a lot of value if you can't have the major party one, making sure that bare majority piece does survive?
Yeah, my guess is that was what people were thinking. And mind you, the bare majority provision goes back to, I think, the 19th century, where the other is from the other major political party was from the 1950s. So they did have one without the other. And some Delaware courts only have the bare majority provision in it. So, you know, if it's looking like you might lose both, then maybe this is a wise decision on their part.
So,
which isn't to say they didn't lose something.
So with the major party rule gone and the bare majority rule still in place, do you see this having an impact on the dynamic of nominating judges? Would having a bench that looked like three Democrats, a Republican, and a non-affiliated person look, feel different? Do you see a practical impact here?
Well, I think I think the question is really to what extent the people involved in the appointment process, first of all, it's going to depend on, you know, who's governor, who's in the Senate, you know, are they the same political party or not? It, you know, it has opened up the door to have more kind of partisan, you know, appointment process, you know, like the in the Court of Appeals, when it said, well, the two provisions go in tandem, is you could have three Democrats on the court. And if you have a Democrat Senate and a Democrat governor, say, and now I'll appoint two Green Party to the other. So the whole court could lean to the left, whereas the other major political party provision, you know, was basically trying to make sure we kept that kind of balance, which, you know, I think there's a good argument was a beneficial thing. So potentially now, you know, if people want to follow the Delaware way and try to be balanced and be inclusive, you know, there's, you know, I would imagine that in practice, things might not change so much. And even if you have some, you know, smaller parties, they might be, you know, James Adams for a long time was a Democrat, you know, he might be put into, if there's three Republicans, a Democrat seat or something. So my guess is it probably is not going to dramatically alter things, but it leaves the door open at least.
There is a little loophole there, you're saying.
Yeah, well, sure.
The last question for you is, do you think that this might lead to an opening of the door for non-affiliated or you know, minor party affiliated people to seek these appointments? Or it sounds like you're saying that it's probably could have stayed the same, but do you think there's a possibility that it does in fact do what Adams has kind of argued, which is kind of like open it up a little bit more than it is right now?
Well, I mean, by definition, it does, because the way it was structured is if you were not a member of one of the two major political parties, you couldn't qualify, you know, for some of these judicial seats. That was James Adams' claim. He was basically saying, I am being discriminated against because I don't affiliate with the Republicans or the Democrats, and that violates my First Amendment right to associate with a political party. And that you're penalizing me. You know, you are like the new Democratic sheriff in the lead case who came in office and say, who's Republican? You're fired, right? Now, the truth is it wasn't exactly the equivalent. In some ways, the Delaware Constitution is the opposite, because it was restraining the governor from just saying, I could only have my people on the court. You know, he had to pick people from the other party. So I just add this, you know, part of me feels like Delaware did lose something good in giving up the other major political party. Like I said, it does at least open the door to having a situation where you have three Democrats and then they appoint two Green Party people. So the whole court slants in one direction, whereas the other way, it assured that you have a balance between the two major political parties. And there's something to be said for balance. I think on the United States Supreme Court, when we had a more balanced court, you know, balanced on either side with O'Connor and Kennedy being swing votes, in many ways, I think the decisions that came out of the court were consonant with where the American public was. And we just saw recently, by happenstance because of politics, where there was a sharp shift in the court in one partisan direction. And I think we've already seen the court producing decisions that are kind of out of kilter, out of line with where a lot of Americans are. So, you know, Delaware may have been on to something good there. And it may be, you know, unfortunate, even if perhaps they felt their hands were tied, you know, that they gave part of it up.
Thanks to Widener University Delaware Law School Professor Alan Garfield for his time on The Green this week. And as Black History Month begins, we look at how the country recognizes Black history and where it comes up short in understanding its significance. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Since the mid-1970s, February has been recognized federally as Black History Month. The celebration started as Negro History Week back in 1926 and expanded in 1976 to a full month under President Gerald Ford. This year, the month's theme is Black Resistance. Educators take time to focus on the theme and highlight the lives of icons such as Harriet Tubman, Martin Luther King Jr., and Rosa Parks. But critics say Black history is American history, history that reaches all the way back to the nation's founding, and it should be integrated throughout the school year, not relegated to a single month. Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon recently sat down with Delaware State University Professor Donna Patterson, chair of DSU's Department of History, Political Science, and Philosophy, and Africana Studies Program Director, to learn more about how Black history is so entwined in the larger arc of our country that it cannot be separated.
So, Dr. Patterson, to start, how would you assess the general knowledge of African-American history among your students?
The general knowledge of African-American history among my students varies. It varies considerably. Some students come in, they have great knowledge. Some of them have learned things in K-12. Some of them have learned things in the community, sometimes from family, or even done some research on their own. And in some schools in the state of Delaware, for instance, Caesar Rodney offers a African-American history course. And so some students take that. And I found, for instance, students who've taken that before they come to class, they have a really strong basis. Students in some other states have taken similar classes or doing some things at home. And so they have bases that could also vary depending on what they're reading and how far they go in terms of their exploration. And so it really varies. And then I also have students who come in who know absolutely nothing or very little about African-American history, maybe the little bits and pieces that they've been taught growing up in K-12. I think that's definitely expanded even, you know, in the last few decades and certainly since I was in school and generations before me, but it's still in some cases is very limited.
And I want to touch on that K-12 aspect of things, but, you know, we're talking today, it's Black History Month. And one thing I've just always been very interested in is this, essentially this push and pull, right, between, you know, Black history being American history, and yet, you know, it's one month that is set aside to, you know, put a spotlight on it, but there is still that reality where it is a 12-month thing. I've read many times that if there hadn't been centuries of deliberate suppression of African-American history, there wouldn't be this resulting ignorance, essentially, that leaves many Americans not seeing a problem. What do we know about how that kind of deliberate suppression worked?
So Black History Month actually started as Black History Week. By Carter G. Woodson, Dr. Carter G. Woodson, African-American historian and scholar, got his PhD actually from Harvard University. And so he started Negro History Week in the early 20th century. So it started as a week and it expanded out into a month later. And so that is how we got Black History Month. He started Negro History Week in February, because some people say, oh, it's the shortest month in the year, but he actually started the week in February. And so as it expanded out, it became February as a month. And so that is those are the foundations there. And I think definitely there are some strengths to having a Black History Month, because in a lot of cases, the history that students and other people, students, their parents, people in the community, that may be the only time that they're really thinking about any type of Black history. And so they will often get some sort of either instruction, programming, enrichment. And so often people will get things that they may not have gotten if they're not seeking those things, or maybe if they're not studying these areas. But certainly, just like all history, it is intricate and it's multifaceted and it weaves through the American society. So in terms of suppression, I mean, I think there are cases where you can argue that there is suppression of Black history. There are also cases where people just are ignorant of Black history. So we may not say that they're willingly suppressing, they just don't know. So how do you teach something or share about something that you may not know? But I think when you look at the history of the Black American experience in the US, a lot of the early history definitely was tied to racial suppression and also this is in some ways othering people who were Black. When I teach African-American history, I also taught world history. I have training in African history and Latin American Caribbean is my primary training. But if you look in those areas and you look at Europe and you look at global history, particularly like I've taught ancient history, for instance, slavery always existed. Slavery always existed globally, going back to antiquity. You can look at early societies in different parts of the world, in the Middle East, in Asia, in Latin America, different places in Africa, slavery existed. It exists well before we get to the transatlantic slave trade, which brings slaves to the Americas. But when you look at slavery historically in a lot of societies, it looks different. There are cases where people can transcend slavery, maybe working a certain period of time, or maybe reproducing with someone who is free, or buying themselves out of slavery, or those sorts of things. Or maybe if they convert to a certain religion, and then they can be free. But also another big feature that we see in a lot of slavery and a lot of kind of old world ideas about slavery is that slavery is not tied to race. And we can think about, for instance, the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire at its height stretches from roughly England to like the edge of India, goes around the Mediterranean, takes in parts of North Africa, Tunisia, Egypt, and these sorts of things. So it's really huge at its height. And as Rome expands, they enslave people that they conquer. And so they have slaves who are brown and Black and white and, you know, who present day, you know, you might say are from the Middle East, or you may say are from Europe, or you may say are from Africa, for instance. But it is not tied to race. And if you look at other societies, that is often the case. But what happens with the transatlantic slave trade, where slaves are taken from Africa and brought to the Americas, it becomes linked to race. And we see that in the United States to a great degree. And even who's enslaved in the United States, because early in the United States, you had people who were either unfree or semi-free or enslaved. And the early labor was often not people of African descent. So you had indentured servants who tended to be Europeans, and you had Native Americans who'd been enslaved. But as it goes on, this idea of tying it to people of African descent becomes more apparent in U.S. history, if you will. And so I think when you kind of look at those intersections, to answer your question, you see the foundations of some of that.
Well, come back to something you touched on earlier about K-12 education, what do you make of that education then that K-12 students get on Black history? I know for me, at least, I remember growing up, obviously it was very thin, but I had a fourth grade class and we obviously didn't learn about anyone beyond Martin Luther King Jr. or Rosa Parks. But I remember they wanted us to act out the Underground Railroad and they set up a whole day to do that at our school. And I find that incredibly problematic on a number of levels. But what do you make of that education K-12 students get on Black history?
So you said you learned about MLK and Rosa Parks growing up.
Those two. Yeah.
And I think, you know, those are people that a lot of people learn about. I learned about Harriet Tubman. You didn't even get Harriet Tubman?
Maybe.
Harriet Tubman. But there are schools that really try to incorporate this curriculum throughout. It's going to vary by school district in some cases. It's going to vary by teacher, sometimes teacher interest, sometimes just teacher background, because a lot of the teachers that are teaching history may not have taken any Black history. We're seeing two big trends, I think, and through the country right now, in terms of looking at the 21st century and what this is looking like. So you're seeing some states like the state of Delaware. You know, House Bill 198 was recently passed in the state. With that bill, schools in the state of Delaware are supposed to incorporate some bit of Black history throughout the state curriculum. So certain school districts in the state are either had things or expanding upon those things, some not doing it as much. And hopefully in the future, some will do, you know, some more in ways that work for them, because I think, too, it's important. And I think, you know, this initiative for House Bill 198, it came from the students. It was something that students asked for. I think they were high school students because, you know, they were older because they understood these things and they wanted to hear more about their experience in their classes. And so that's where it came from. It wasn't this, you know, even though the state voted and, you know, it's ratified at the state level, it really started from the bottom up.
And historically, I will say, yeah, the education piece is so, so critical. Historically, you know, we're talking about these figures, these very visible figures, people like Martin Luther King Jr., you know, he's known for leading the civil rights movement, but in reality, you know, he was just one of many, right?
Absolutely. There were so many different people and so many other organizations. You know, he was a pastor and he was one of the leads of the SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, you know, which was prominent and would partner with some of the other organizations. For instance, he often partnered with NAACP, and sometimes they were partner with CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, but also SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And so you had all of these different civil rights groups. Martin Luther King was one of many. He led SCLC with someone named Reverend Ralph Abernathy, who was actually senior to him. And then also they had other people who worked with him, including Bayard Rustin. You had Stokely Carmichael, Julian Bond. Women were very involved. Two very prominent women were Ella Baker and Fannie Lou Hamer.
I'm glad you touched on women here, because folks like Sojourner Truth, you know, Ain't I a Woman, women like Shirley Chisholm. Yes. Outside of just women, though, how is it that these figures, these leaders, how are they lost throughout the translation of history?
Well, I don't know if they're ever lost. I don't know if these historical figures are ever lost. I think that there are always people who have that historical memory. There's also that historical documentation, because we haven't even talked really about literature and writing and research and scholarship, for instance. And so there were always people trying to document this history. And particularly, I think, if you're looking early on, it was harder, kind of the early centuries of U.S. history. You know, a lot of people of African descent could not read and write, or had limited ability to read and write because they were forbidden to read and write. But also, I think literacy broadly in the country was not that widespread. So there were a lot of white people who, and other people of other backgrounds, who could not read and write or do these things fluently. But in the 19th century, one of the things that we start to see, when you're looking at kind of the foundations of the creation of Black history as a discipline, that there are people that are starting to write these things and document these things in academic fashion. So this happens starting in the 19th century. You know, moving into the late 19th, early 20th century, there is more of that. W.E.B. Du Bois, he was someone who documented a lot of this history, but also other aspects of the African-American experience. Carter G. Woodson documented aspects of the African-American experience.
Well, an article I read recently, I can't remember who the author is, but it concluded with the hope that people will soon recognize essentially Black history as American history. When do you think that day will come?
I mean, I think kind of given some of the political climate that we see right now, it's hard to say when that would happen. And often I think when you listen to a lot of the opposition to it, a lot of the people opposing haven't really studied it. So do they really know what's contained? I mean, you could read this script or this table of contents and imagine what's there, but did you actually read it? Do you really know what's there? Because I know there's this debate coming out of Florida right now, for instance, with the AP African American Studies course. And now Governor DeSantis has said that they're going to ban it in the state. And now the College Board is saying they're going to go back and review and change some things. I think in some ways we're seeing a movement backwards about how people are viewing Black history.
Thanks to Delaware State University Professor Donna Patterson and our Kyle McKinnon for joining us on The Green this week. And we wrap up The Green next with Arts Playlist, where we tell you about a poetry workshop timed just right for those looking for the right words for that special someone on Valentine's Day. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. William Shakespeare, Emily Dickinson, Robert Frost, Walt Whitman, Maya Angelou are just a few of the great poets who masterfully wielded words and showcased poetry's uncanny ability to calm, console, and connect us to the minds and feelings of others. And chances are, at some point in your life, you've read or written poetry in some form. But whether you have or not, you now have an opportunity through Delaware Shakespeare's Create Your Own Love Poem Workshop. In this week's edition of Arts Playlist, our Kyle McKinnon spoke with Rachel O'Hanlon Rodriguez, poet, actor, teaching artist, and instructor of Delaware Shakespeare's Poetry Workshop, about this workshop and all things poetry.
Well, Rachel, there's so much stimulus and technology and distraction around us at all times, especially in 2023. How would you describe poetry's place and impact in a time like this?
I feel like poetry is about taking up space, both for yourself. And when you share a poem with others, it's an offering. It's a gift from your body, from your perspective to another. So I think poetry for me allows us to slow down and reclaim the present moment and focus on the little details, right? Like for me, poetry is like, how can I communicate what it feels like to see the sunrise if you've never seen a sunrise? You know, getting into every single detail and getting really curious about your feelings and your sensory experience. So I think the process of writing poetry is an invitation to the present moment, to slow down and really enjoy your experience in your body.
I could not have said that any better myself. And I'm a poetry lover. I've read, and I'll get to that in a sec, but I've read only scant amounts of Emily Dickinson, but she said this about poetry, which I really love. She said, "If I read a book and it makes my whole body so cold, no fire can ever warm me, I know that is poetry. If I feel physically as if the top of my head were taken off, I know that is poetry. These are the only way I know it. Is there any other way?" So I'm asking you, Rachel, why are you a poet? Why do you read, you know, what do you love about poetry? You know, why do you read and write it?
You know, I'm a lover of story. And I think story is how humans often learn throughout history, right? I believe our ancestors sat around fires and told ourselves stories of survival. It's how we pass down information and knowledge. And sometimes stories can get really, you know, heavy and dense and long. And for me, a poem can tell a story in such a short amount of time. It's like a bottling magic to me, because poetry can take on so many different forms and so many different shapes, so many different languages and cultures. And yet at the end, there's still this like seed of a story within it. But the story doesn't need to be linear in poetry the way that regular stories or even plays often need to function. A poem can tell you the story of an experience or a memory, a tiny moment in time. And I think that's what I really love about poetry, is it's not always trying to capture the whole. Sometimes it's trying to capture just a small part of a larger collage of our life. And I think that that's what I love about it, the juxtaposition of capturing a small part of what it means to have our humanity or to enjoy our human experience.
Yeah, I feel as though poetry is close to the origin of language overall. It really, you can express the inexpressible. You know, why do you think it's poetry though, as that medium that can convey or evoke, you know, certain feelings or thoughts and emotions that other mediums can't?
I find poetry to be in a lot of different art forms, but maybe disguised in a different form. Like musicians might not consider themselves poets, but lyrics are poetry as well. Hip hop is rhythm and poetry. That's rap. To be a rapper is to be a poet, to play with the rhythm of life. But I think why poetry is so connected to probably the evolution of linguistics and the written word is that we are creatures of a sensory experience. We as humans have a desire to share our experience with others. And I think it's an act of generosity. We want other people to also enjoy something we enjoy or be sad about something that was deeply upsetting to us. So I think poetry gets at that. How do you explain the little details or try to get someone to understand your personal experience? And I think that that's where poetry comes in. I mean, it's imagery, it's metaphor, it's playing with words, because life is tricky like that. And how do you get to explain that it's both tricky and fun and sad? And I think that that's why our poetry comes in.
Well, let's talk the L word then. That's kind of the theme of the workshop you're instructing, the Delaware Shakespeare's Create Your Own Love Poem Workshop. Some of the very best poetry I've ever read is about love, you know, whether it be longing or love lost, heartbreak, you know, and so on. Why do you think poetry lends itself to an emotion and a feeling such as love so well?
I mean, love is complicated, right? Like, all you need is love, but actually you kind of need more than just love. Our experience of love throughout our life really changes, right? Like when you're a child, your idea of love is different than when you are a teenager. And when you're a teenager, you think you have love figured out. And then you get a little older and you're like, wow, love is complicated. And yet it's simple. And I think that's the thing that connects it to poetry. Poetry is complicated, and yet it's very simple. And I think that we're trying to always figure something out. Like love is almost like a mystery that if we could figure it out, we'd have like, I don't know, a mathematical formula for it, and then we can control it and life would be easier. But love is uncontrollable. It's a force all around us that we both activate and receive, you know? So I think there's an excitement of it and also a universality of it. You know, we all know someone that has loved and lost or found love that we admire. So I think that in the same way that we are connected with how we use words very often, how we explore our experience, I think love is one of those very easy things for us to latch onto. So I think love connects us in the sense that we all experience it in a very uncontrollable way.
Again, you put that better than I ever could. And it's universal, and there's everyone's experiences are so distinctive. But again, this all segues perfectly into Delaware Shakespeare's Create Your Own Love Poem Workshop, which you're instructing, as I just mentioned. Could you tell us about that workshop and what's it all about for those that don't know?
So, you know, I can't promise folks will leave this Delaware Shakespeare workshop as strong of a writer as Shakespeare. But what I'm excited about is to look at Shakespeare's text and demystify the writing process, right? Like when we look at a Shakespeare sonnet, we see the sum of many parts and the power of it. But when we look at it, it's just like, okay, that's metaphor, that's symbol. This is how rhythm works, right? There are little ingredients, let's say. It's like a beautiful dish, but we didn't know what the ingredients were. So if we actually kind of unpack some famous love poems, we can maybe demystify this process. I also think that there are many folks that write in this world, but maybe don't consider themselves poets or writers. I think that often in our culture, there's this idea of like, oh, who deserves creativity or who can be considered a creative? I believe everyone has the capacity for creativity. I think that everyone can enjoy and learn something from engaging in that creative process. So for me, I'm really excited about demystifying our ideas of what writing is and allowing ourselves to find out what can become when we allow ourselves to have the space. So there's going to be opportunities to like adapt your own Shakespeare if that's what you feel excited about. There's going to be writing prompts to be like, what image comes to mind when we consider a couple of these questions, right? Like, what does love feel like? What does love taste like? What does love smell like? We all have a different answer to that. And I think all of them are beautiful. And then what does it mean when we just embellish them more and give it more space? So it's going to be a lot of playing and daring ourselves to take up as much space as we want.
I love that. Well, what about experience levels? Again, you kind of touched on this just now, but you know, anyone can dive right in, right?
Yep. Yep. And I'm a trauma-informed teaching artist and learner. And so what that means is I really try to engage the folks in the room based on what their needs and curiosities are. So what is exciting about this workshop is I don't quite know who will be in the room yet. So I have some, like, I have a very large lesson plan and structure, but inside of it is a lot of open space for different paths for individual learners to go down, because no one learns the same and no one writes the same. So beginners, folks that are really experienced, if they're more experienced than me, I would love to learn from them. you know? And this will be a little community of people in this workshop. So I believe we can all learn from each other's voices, and everyone's creativity is valid and powerful.
I think you've sold me, Rachel. I think you've sold me. Well, where should you go? You know, what should you do if you want to take part? Should you just visit the Delaware Shakespeare website?
Yeah. So it's delshakes.org. And it's right on their homepage. There's a little banner, create your own love poem. And there are two sessions. There's one this upcoming Saturday and the following Saturday. But folks can attend one or the other. I'll make the materials of one session available to the other. And because I love people so much, it's also going to come with like individual time. If you can't make it to one of the sessions, but you want to workshop your poem with me, we're going to make space for that to happen if that's what folks need to engage and create their own love poem.
Thanks to Rachel O'Hanlon-Rodriguez and Arkham McKinnon for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, The Green can also be found via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, the NPR One app, and the Delaware Public Media app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks, as always, to our show producer, Kyle McKinnon, for putting all the pieces of the puzzle together. For Kyle and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Bernstein. Thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.